Welcome to my presence. So I went to Europe, right? It was delightful. I visited half a dozen communes over there. I went there specifically with two things that I was looking for. One was how groups in different situations at different sizes make consensus work for them. And the other was how income-sharing communes survive and even thrive in urban environments. Because this is the project that I am embarking on with Point A. And from my experience living at Acorn Community, which is a member of the Federation of Egalitarian Communities for 9.5 years, I've constructed like an understanding of the egalitarian communities that exist in the U.S., and I was looking for other models to help inform me and to allow me to tell more stories and more interesting stories to people here in the U.S. who otherwise might see the range of options at the FEC and think that it's all of the options that exist. So a lot of this talk involves comparing the European communes to the FEC communes, and so I'm going to start with a quick explanation of the FEC and its member communes, and then we'll move on to Europe. A couple of disclaimers before I start is that, the biggest one is that I visited each of these communes for a maximum of 5 days and talked to a maximum of 5 people, selected mainly by who spoke the best English. So my impressions of these communes are very particular and should be taken with a grain of salt, especially because I know that if somebody came to my commune and stayed for 5 days and talked to 5 random people who spoke Spanish, like, and said that they knew exactly what was going on at Acorn, I would know that they were full of shit. So the FEC, the Federation of Egalitarian Communities, right? In the U.S., there are several thousand, 2,000 or 4,000 different intentional communities, groups of people living together with some common purpose or some sort of membership process, right? Out of all of those, I am interested in only a very small selection. Something like half of them are spiritual communities. So religious, or they have got a guru, or some spiritual, common spiritual practice. And that's not so interesting to me. I'm interested mainly in communes as a social laboratory for what might be, for a new sort of society. And so I want to be exploring secular communes that are open to anybody of any sort of religious or spiritual persuasion, or none. And then out of the remaining intentional communities, the vast majority of them are not particularly economically interesting, because one of my huge concerns with the world is the way that the economy is set up, and sort of what I see as the unnecessary inhumanity and cruelty of it. And the vast majority of intentional communities do nothing radical to address that. A lot of them, there's some significant buy-in in order to get property there. You have to have your own job or have a bunch of money on your own. There's limited amounts of sharing and cooperation and solidarity between members. So the things that I'm particularly interested in are embodied by the Federation of Egalitarian Communities, which out of those thousands of intentional communities in the U.S. contains 7 members, 7 member communes. And we suspect that there's probably 2 or 3 times as many potential FEC communes out there, of which only 7 are members of the Federation. So what sets the Federation apart is that it has 7 core principles, right? The first 2 are that we hold our land, labor, income, and other resources in common, and the second is that we assume responsibility for the needs of our members, right? Assuming or receiving the products of their labor and distributing them and all other goods equally or according to need, right? So this is a long-winded way of saying from each according to their ability to each according to their need, that inside of the communes we have fundamentally change the rules of the economy from one of either a fair exchange of value or whatever I can negotiate, which is the market principle, to one of everybody contributes what they can and they take what they need, to a needs-based economy and a solidarity-based economy. 3rd principle is that we practice nonviolence. 4th is that we are democratic in some fashion, and the different communes do this in different ways. The 5th is that we actively work to establish the equality of all people and don't permit discrimination. I say it's like we don't discriminate in ways that make us assholes, basically. Six is we act to conserve natural resources. We try to be eco-groovy or ecologically sensitive in some way. And the seventh is we create processes for group communication and participation and provide an environment which supports people's development. So basically we try to not like have a collectivity and have a communality that supports people in expressing their own desires and their own sort of unique selfness and developing their selfness. So adhering to these seven principles in a diversity of ways are the seven member communities. I'm going to talk about six of them because the seventh one is relatively new and is still forming and figuring out its processes. And so there's about half a dozen that are particularly interesting to talk about because they've worked out their shit, as it were. And I'm going to group them in a couple of ways. So the first grouping would be what I'm calling the Cat Kincaid communities, right? And that is Twin Oaks, Eastwind, and Acorn. And I call them the Cat Kincaid communities because they were all founded, although by different groups of people, they had a common founder for all three of them, and that was this woman, Cat Kincaid, who also wrote a couple of books. But the big thing about them is not that Cat Kincaid was a common founder of all of them, it's rather that Twin Oaks actually started both of them. Or all three, if you think of Twin Oaks as starting itself. And all of those communities have a largely common mold in a lot of ways. And Eastwind and Acorn that came off of Twin Oaks largely copy Twin Oaks, except when they are reacting to things that they didn't like at Twin Oaks. And so you look at them, and when you see difference, you see that difference as being very explicitly chosen. But in general, the baseline is whatever Twin Oaks is doing. All of the Cat Kincaid communes are sort of weird in that their like guiding principle or mission is somewhat vague. And in a way, that's a problem because there's not a huge amount of focus and direction in the communities, but in a way it's also a strength because it allows a bunch of people to come together and pursue their own aims underneath of a common umbrella. And the reason for that is, in large part, I think, because Twin Oaks actually started as a behaviorist experiment. Although it was started in the 60s, I think 1967, it was not actually a hippie commune. They are actually kind of worried when the hippies showed up, but it was inevitable because you make a commune, the hippies are going to show up. They're actually started by a bunch of behaviorists, fans of B.F. Skinner, and they started as a copy of Walden II. Which is this book that he wrote describing his ideal society run according to behaviorist principles. And they did that for a couple of years and then figured out that it's not the best idea to base your commune on a science fiction book by somebody who has no experience actually running a micro-society. And so they gave up a lot of it. And now the commune, although it has a lot of behaviorist elements still sort of hiding in it, is no longer explicitly interested in behaviorism. But after that, they had their guiding principles, like the FEC principles, but besides that, they're just sort of creating a good life and trying to spread egalitarianism in the world. They all ended up doing different things as far as governance goes, because Twin Oaks started off pulling this system from the book, which is this wacky consensus-inspired bureaucratic democracy that takes about 15 minutes to explain, and which nobody that I know of has ever tried to copy. Right. It's called the planner-manager system. It works for them insofar as they haven't folded, and there are some advantages to the system, but nobody has looked at it and said, yeah, we should do that. So actually, several years, something like 6 or 7 years after Twin Oaks started, a group of people broke off and founded Eastwind in Missouri. And Eastwind is largely the same as Twin Oaks, except that they decided that the planner-manager system took too long to make decisions, and it was unclear when a decision was actually made, and so they thought, well, we'll just do majority vote. So they just do majority vote. And then 20 years later, Acorn was started, and Acorn looked at both Twin Oaks and Eastwind and said, well, we really don't like how either of those work. And at that point, consensus had taken the radical left world by storm, and so they decided to use consensus. The thing that is consistent across all of the Cat Kincaid communities, however, is the way that they run their economy. Right? So all three communes have an economy based on the labor quota, where the community requires a certain amount of labor done by each of its members for the communal good every week, which is roughly, it's 35 to 42, depending on the commune. And then all of the products of that communal labor are owned communally and then distributed according to need. And the system is egalitarian because it is based on hours of labor done, not what sort of labor is done, and not by effort, and not by product. It's just how many hours you're actually doing for the community. And it includes domestic work, administrative work, income-producing work of all sorts. But the communities have a dual economy, right? So there's this certain amount of hours that you owe the commune, and all of the products of that labor are owned and distributed collectively. But those products, like the commune does not, and explicitly does not, cover all of the needs or all of the things that you could possibly want in the world, right? All three communities democratically determine what they are going to cover, and generally speaking, what they cover is what you need in order to live a decent life, which is determined democratically by the commune. And the idea is that everybody could live entirely within the collective economy and be just fine. But in order for people to take care of needs and desires that they have outside of the collective economy, or outside of what the communes provide, they have a private economy running alongside the communal economy. And for that, the communes pay all of their members a certain small allowance or stipend every month. And in addition, you can take your time outside of the time that you owe the commune and earn money somehow or another, and then that money is put into your private account and you can use it for private things, what is considered by the community's luxuries, which could be simple things like booze or tobacco, or it could be vacations, or it could be some exotic desire of yours that is not widely shared. So that's the Kekkonkade communes. Then there's and the Kekkonkade communes are the largest and, for the most part, the oldest of the FEC communes. Twin Oaks is 95 adults and 17 children. Eastwind is about 70 adults and some number of children. Acorn is 30 adults and one kid. And they've been around for 20 years, 40 years, and 47 years, respectively. Next is Sandhill, which sort of stands by itself. Sandhill is a small, I think maximum size of a dozen right now. It's got 5 members, rural commune out in Missouri. And it was started with the intention of being an egalitarian income-sharing commune with a sort of the feel of a small, intimate family farm, but with non-related individuals, right? And so they're explicitly making their income from agricultural pursuits. They're living in this intimate way with each other. And they govern themselves by consensus, and sort of notably have governed themselves by consensus for something like 40-some years. They started a few years after Twin Oaks started. But then with their economy, they do not have the dual economy. They have a unitary economy, where quite simply all income produced by any member of the commune in any way goes into a common pot. And then what they say is, everyone is a check signer, right? So anything that you need, you just take the money for what you need. Need to go see your family, you take the money. Need to buy some booze, you take the money. Whatever. And they don't have the labor quota system either. They have a casual regulation of labor. Everybody is expected to do their fair share for the commune. And what that is and what it is that you're going to be doing is regulated by sort of your own self-discipline, but also conversation between the different members and within the consensus group. But there are no formal requirements of a certain number of hours, certain types of work, or anything like that. And my experience from living at Acorn and being more familiar with the Kekkonkade communes is that the Kekkonkade communes look on this sort of more radical and interesting economy that Sandhill runs, and they assume that it is only possible because Sandhill is tiny, intimate, and they're so far out in the middle of nowhere that it's hard to spend money anyway, right? So then all of those communes, the Kekkonkade communes and Sandhill, are rural communities. But within the FEC, there are actually 2 urban communes, Emma Goldman Finishing School in Seattle and the Midden in Columbus, Ohio. And they are also largely on the same model because the Midden mostly copied Emma Goldman Finishing School when they started up. Both of them were started up with the purpose of cutting their living expenses drastically and improving their quality of life and their personal resiliency so that they could afford to do the social justice work they wanted to do in the world. For Emma Goldman, it was so that they could afford to work the poorly paying and benefited social justice jobs that they wanted to work. And for the Midden, it was so that they could cut costs so drastically they could work as little as humanly possible and do all the unpaid anarchist organizing work they wanted to do. They both are sort of maximum size of about a dozen people. They both run by consensus. They both have a dual economy, like Twin Oaks and Acorn and Eastwind. But they manage it not so much through a labor system as through a complicated taxation formula. All members are expected to have some way of earning income outside of the house, and then how that income is divided between the communal economy and the private economy is determined by a relatively complex formula that attempts to inject egalitarianism into the otherwise just sort of market relations that people are having with income and the economy generally. Yeah. And that's the FEC communes. Now, a thing to note about the FEC communes, because I'll be noting it later as a sort of easy metric for judging maybe the intensity or effectiveness of sharing in the communes, is that we've noticed, and in fact this is not a secret or anything, that sharing and cooperating is more efficient, right? This is something that everybody's known for a very long time. And in fact, you can look at capitalism as just a kind of weird and perverse way of convincing people to cooperate with each other. But, you know, so we find that if people are working cooperatively and sharing, and they're able to get what they want for less money, that the income-sharing communes, by encouraging intense cooperation and sharing, are able to cut the amount of money needed to live a certain quality of life drastically. And our presumption as to why this is that by having an income-sharing community, you flip the normal or the default way of consuming and owning. Whereas if you're living in an individualist economy, right, your default method of consuming and owning is individually. And it takes a special effort. You need to set up a special system. You need to put intention and work into any time that you're actually consuming or owning collectively or cooperatively. Whereas if you set up your economy so that it's income sharing, the default, because all the income is shared, the default is to share all the expenses, to consume and own collectively. And in fact, you have to put extra intention, energy, effort, thought into consuming individually. You have to set aside money for every member. You have to make complex regulations on what money goes to the individual and what money goes to the community and this sort of thing. And so just by doing that, like, we can point at a number of different sharing systems, but presumably just by flipping that basic relation, we share in this very, very intense way, and in a way that's hard to pull out because it's just so widespread. But the effects are that you can go to Twin Oaks, which is, by some measures, living a very comfortable, perhaps middle-class quality of life. You have an excellent social safety net, you have amazing maternity and paternity leave, you basically get 3 years off when your child is born, and then it just sort of slowly goes down over the course of the rest of the child's life. You have infinite sick leave, you know, you're completely taken care of, you have delicious organic meals cooked for you twice a day, you know, you have a sauna, you have a pond, etc., etc., comfortable work on your own schedule, and they're doing all of that for between $4,000 and $6,000 per person per year. You go to Acorn, which has a comparable quality of life, except we also have free unlimited coffee and better internet and better vehicular access, and we're doing it for about $8,000 or $9,000 per person per year. You can look at the Midden, where I have the numbers, but I haven't crunched them all. But the sort of star statistic from the Midden is that in 2013, they fed all 7 members of their house for the entire year for $400. Yeah. So anyway, so that's the statistic. So the other thing is that if you have any questions or comments or are suddenly moved, just interrupt me.
How long does it take to get consensus? What happens if we don't have consensus?
If we don't have consensus, then we don't do the thing, I suppose. It depends on the decision, but what is certainly true from living at Acorn for 9.5 years and using consensus with a group of people between 10 and 30, not all of whom agree with each other all of the time. In fact, yeah, some vociferously disagree about a number of things. It's surprisingly easy, actually. Probably 90 to 95% of all proposals that are brought to the community are approved. Probably 80 or 90% of all applicants to the community are approved. Now, most of those proposals that are brought to the community are not approved unmodified. But the vast majority, we say yes. It's actually, that's the thing, that it's a totally preposterous proposal, right? The idea that everybody has to agree in order to do anything. But it's shockingly easy once you get down to it. In part because in order to, my idea is that in order to have an effective consensus process, you have to build a culture that supports it, right? Because everybody can see how utterly absurd the proposal is, right? But so you also know that if you want to do anything, you have to figure out how to make it work, right? How do you make it work? Well, you get other people to be looking at your proposals and wanting to say yes. So you want to be figuring out how you can compromise to say yes to other people so that they will compromise to say yes to you. You want to be able to figure out how to work out your concerns and what it is that you want into the most basic pieces so you can actually talk about those pieces rather than the specifics of any proposal, you know, so that any proposal that comes can be modified so that it continues to meet the need or the desire of the person who made it while at the same time meeting the needs and desires of other people in the room. All sorts of wonderful life skills like that.
You're not sounding like Congress, are you?
No, and it's very different than Congress. Yeah. And actually what's interesting is that Eastwind, which uses majority rule, none of the subsequent FEC communities have considered really doing majority rule. They've all worked with some version of consensus. And part of that is that we look at Eastwind and we see the politics there as being often dysfunctional. And sometimes because of the majority rule thing, that there will be people running around with petitions in order to get people to sign them and not necessarily engaging in trying to find compromise and common ground with each other because you just have to get that 51%. And I actually know people who have been kicked out of Eastwind and don't actually know why. You know, because somebody was able to get 51% of the people to say, get out of here. And their process largely works for them. You know, I don't want to paint them as some sort of like dysfunctional dystopia, but what I hear, and possibly I'm talking to disgruntled people more than gruntled people, but what I hear is that you move to Eastwind for a variety of reasons, but you don't move to Eastwind for the politics. You know. Nut butters, though. Yeah. That's their industry is nut butters. All the nut butters you can eat. If you can ever get cashew macadamia nut butter, I highly recommend it. Okay. So now we go to Europe. So before I start the whole tour of Europe, first thing to point out is that the most striking thing to me of touring all of these communes is that there is a very distinct demographic difference between the European communes and the FEC communes in the US. So the FEC communes in the US, what we notice, particularly at the Kakankia communes, which are the larger ones and so have better statistics, what we notice is that the majority of applicants are either in their 20s or their 50s, right? Now, the communes have a like fairly even spread of ages with a bump in the 20s, but a lot of that spread comes from the population aging in, right? The vast majority of recruits are in their 20s and their 50s.
Is this U.S. or Europe?
U.S. Mm-hmm. And we look at that as very natural because people move to the communes when they're at some transitional moment in their lives, right? Either after they've finished their schooling, whatever sort of schooling they might be doing, and before they've really gotten into a family and career sort of situation, and they're exploring the world and figuring out what they want to do, or after they've retired or gotten divorced or their kids have grown up or all three, you know. And in Europe, what I kept noticing and what people kept telling me, because they were consistently surprised about our demographics, is that they have essentially nobody in their 20s. they get applicants in their 30s and in their 50s. And they think that this is the most natural thing in the world, right? Because people move there during transitional moments in their lives. Like, what sort of self-respecting 20-something is going to move to some commune and settle down, right? You're too busy running around in the city, partying up, like, drinking, exploring the world, et cetera, et cetera. It's not until you get through your 20s and you start calming down and looking to settle down somewhere, maybe start a family or get into a career or something, that you actually move to a commune. And then the 50-year-olds come for the same reason as our 50-year-olds. So what I don't know, and what was interesting to me to consider during this whole process, is what the relationship between the demographics and the structural differences between the European and American communes was. Whether the demographic difference informs the what is possible structurally, or whether the structural differences determine who's attracted to the community, or whether there's some complex interaction, or whether there's actually no relationship whatsoever, and it's just that Europeans are different than Americans, you know, because college is free and they just go to college their whole 20s, or Lord knows what. But it's sort of an unanswered question, because I didn't spend nearly enough time figuring out why. But it's worth keeping in mind.